Okay, thank you very much. I've dispensed with my notes in an effort to weave several bits of narrative together to introduce Danny tonight. I'm truly delighted, both as Professor of Geography here at King's, but also as Director of the School of Global Affairs, to welcome Danny to talk on an issue which clearly is of some significance. Now, I'm sure you've read the blurb that went with the lecture. Kriti's done a very good job of introducing the evening programme that we have here, and we're honoured to host that. Something we took from LSE a little while ago. And the LSE connection is quite interesting because, of course, Halford Mackinder was one of the founders of LSE. For those who don't know, Halford Mackinder, probably one of the three or four most famous geographers in UK history from the 19th and 20th century. He never actually held a chair at Oxford, and in fact he was reader there for a while. So Danny's already outranking Mackinder. You can tell just how distinguished Danny is when you look at the previous incumbents of the chair that he occupies. You've only got to mention Gordon Clark and David Harvey to know the kind of company that we're keeping this evening. When I look back over the last 20 or 30 years of geography, I'm often both proud and also perplexed. Proud because of the richness and diversity of what the modern subject now offers, but perplexed because very often the subject seems to have turned away from its heritage and often been rather introspective, looking at small-scale, micro-political type issues. But Danny Dorling has never been like that. I think he wouldn't mind me saying that he's always been strongly empirically grounded and therefore strongly empirically engaged. He works with maps and space, not as some simple, complicated intellectual representation, or dare I say it, intellectual non-representation, but as a means of making what should be obvious, what should be alarming, what should be challenging, what should be distressing, obvious to us in a way which it simply isn't. So throughout Danny's career as a geographer, there's been two essential things: a person, a place, an empirical grounding, and a deep commitment and deep passion to continually investigate and refresh our knowledge of inequality of various kinds. I'm equally delighted tonight to have environment in the title, because it seems to me that this idea of putting place, people, environment and inequality together is an innately traditional and foundational geographical theme. And on that note about talking of tradition, foundation and geography, I invite you to put your hands together once more for the Halford Mackinder of geography.
Thank you for that very kind introduction. It's rather hard to live up to Halford Mackinder's name. He also created the University of Reading, and he climbed Mount Kenya. He may well have killed some of his porters on the way up Mount Kenya. And he also introduced a theory to the world, which said that if you couldn't control the world island, if you couldn't control the centre of the world, then you wouldn't have power. The Americans took this to heart, and it almost resulted in the world ending, because it's a central theory of the Cold War. And these kind of issues do relate to what I've got to talk to you about tonight. And they also relate, I didn't know the byline of Shevelin, but the future belongs to those who create it. And this is about the future. I mean, you could say the future belongs to those who take it sometimes, or if you've been a bit kinder, the future will belong to those who are careful enough that we actually have a future. We've got talks coming up in Paris in a few weeks' time, which are about these issues. I want to talk about social inequalities and overconsumption, why they both persist, but also how they may be related, and things that we have only just begun to be able to see, because the circumstances have only just arisen for us to be able to measure them and see that there may well be a connection between economic inequality, social economic inequality, and the amount that we buy, that we waste, and that we pollute. And if the relationships I'm going to show you throughout the course of this lecture are true, the implications are very, very wide-ranging. They suggest that behaving in certain ways, in ways that certain countries have promoted, is going to be incredibly damaging, whereas there are other countries in the world that you can look at where if we behave more like them, the future is somewhat more assured. Social inequality and economic inequality is what I am happiest talking about. Environmental and consumption inequalities are something I've only looked at in the last 5 or 6 years. But it's been the changes that I've seen in that have made me think that these are worth looking at in closer detail. A lot of the data is very poor. I am empirical and I do bore people about the data, but I do have to warn you, in the last 5 years, a lot of these numbers have changed very, very abruptly. We do not know that accurately how much gasoline people consume in different countries. We do not know that accurately how much waste is generated, how much is recycled. One thing which is incredibly irksome is that countries which are generally better behaved are better at measuring things. And so that when they measure things that are bad, they tend to produce higher numbers. I think the most extreme example of this is probably gender issues. If you look at the European survey of women who have been harassed, who have had sexual harassment, you'll find the highest rates of sexual harassment are in Scandinavia. Now, it's not, I think, that Scandinavian men are particularly bad. It's that Scandinavian women are very good at knowing what is sexual harassment. And I'll come up with examples of this later. Here's a different image of the world, one which I'm guessing most of you haven't seen. It's an image of the world that I'm very familiar with. It's an image where we've reshaped the globe so that each small area of land, not just each country, but each small area of land is the size of its population. So India is in the middle. India is in the middle on many, many projections of the world if you do it this way. Africa is roughly the same size as India. China is roughly the same size. And that small little part of Northwest Europe is on the edge up there. I'll put it even further to the edge in a minute. The lines are the trade routes of ships. They're the lines of underground submarine cables. They're the lines that aircraft take. They're the flow lines of the world economy. An attempt to show you how people move around the world. And the dark line is showing you the maiden voyage of what was, until 6 months ago, the world's largest ever ship. The problem about writing about the world's largest ships is that whenever you're writing about the largest ship, somebody is laying the keel down in Korea for an even larger one. And by the time you've published about the world's largest ship, it is no longer the largest ship. But this ship, which began in China, worked its way around through the straits near Singapore, up through the Suez Canal, around the Straits of Gibraltar, and contained enough goods that it would take 100 miles worth of container lorries to replicate what was on that ship. And what was on that ship were largely things that within a few years will end up in landfill, because that's the way we produce and consume at the moment. Not necessarily landfill in Europe, because some of those containers are filled up with waste, and the waste is actually taken back to China to be processed in China. Why do we have this global pattern? I'll just tell you my little theory of the world in 30 seconds so you know where I'm coming from. Until about 400 years ago, Rotterdam, that little northwest part of Europe, was the back end of nowhere. It really was a place you wouldn't choose to be. And then, with the so-called discovery of what in effect was a new planet, the Americas, Europe suddenly ends up in centre stage in the world. That's the primary reason why so many goods move to Europe and now to North America, and thirdly to Japan. It's a historical accident, it's a discovery, it is an unsettling of a world system that occurred in 1492, that meant that a large amount of silver could be moved out of the Americas. The Americas had no hope because they didn't have smallpox, so the population was decimated, and that silver allowed Europe to become the wealthiest part in the world, and we're seeing the echoes, the end of that world system. On top of that, though, there was coal. And coal allowed us, for a few hundred years, and oil and other fossil fuels, to do things that we haven't been able to do before, and things that we will not be able to do in the future. That's my potted history in 30 seconds. Most academics are far too serious to do that, but I thought I'd have a go. I'm going to show you quite a few graphs like this later, so I thought I'd show you one without any labels on it. These are countries. Does anybody want to have a guess as to what the two large circles might be? Somebody said China. I heard China. That's good. What's the other one? Not US. Country the same population as China back then, almost? India. Okay, I thought I should put this in. This is spurious. The fact that this thing is a relationship is largely chance. But this data comes from the Paris Top Income Sets data. It's the data Thomas Piketty used in his book. And it's data on life expectancies and income inequality. So along the bottom, we've got the take of the richest 1%. This is, I think, around 2009. Very unequal country here, a bit more equal here, quite equal here for countries that are not in the richest 25. And along the side we've got life expectancy, again around about 2009. And here's the names of the countries. Now, you'd never get a relationship this close other than partly by chance. It's not that one thing is causing the other, of course, there are much more important and long-range reasons for the differences in life expectancy in those countries. But it is still remarkable that the only countries with life expectancies below about 77 in the Paris Top Income data set actually line up that well when you look at life expectancy, which is one of our measures of social well-being. People never study these countries when they're talking about economic inequality. They study, as I'm about to do, the 25 richest countries of the world. But I just thought I'd show you that to say that I think it is about time we began to look at social and economic inequalities in countries other than the richest, and it might well be quite fruitful. But that's, I'm afraid, all I'm going to tell you about the poorer three quarters of the world. Except for one more map. This is the same map as before, but now we've taken out the oceans. So now you are looking at about 7.2 billion people. If you have this map as your screensaver on your screen and you've had a map like it for about 20 years, as I have, you get very used to it and you begin to see the planet as being like this. You begin to see your travels as being travels over people, not over land. But it will be an odd perspective for most of you. The UK only has 1%, less than 1% now, of the world's population. Even if we get all the population growth that ONS is forecasting, which they're forecasting because we have had the most incredible rate of immigration in the last 15 years, even if we get all that population growth, which we're only going to get from immigration, we're still going to be less than 1% of the world's population. We only have 0.5% of the world's children in this country. But, as the Chancellor of the Exchequer reminded us recently, we have 6% of the world's welfare bill. So what a terrible country we are, that we're spending so much on welfare when we only have 1% of the world's population. The thing that the Chancellor missed out, I think he missed it out because he simply didn't know it or understand it, I don't think he was being devious, was that the vast majority of the welfare bill of the world is a bill paid for in the rich countries. So once you share it out, once you compare rich countries, you find that in fact we have one of the lowest, cheapest welfare bills of any rich country. It only becomes that higher proportion when you are looking at it spread out across the whole globe. But let me get back to the point of my lecture. For those of you who weren't so studious as to read it, here is what I want to say, so you get one more chance to look. This is causing increased interest. That there may be relationships which are much stronger than we thought before between the degree of inequality that a society is willing to tolerate and its environmental footprint, but also its school system and its housing system and its transport system. Now, it is not that one thing is causing the other, but it also is not coincidence that the things are related. Okay. Correlation is not causation, but it is not coincidence. You cannot get what I'm about to show you purely by chance. What I think you're getting is those countries where a larger proportion of the population have managed to gain control, have got a grip in things, organise things better. Those countries in which a small group of the population, invariably the elite, the richest of the population, have got control, and people not very far beneath them don't have very much control, begin to organise things in worse and worse ways. Possibly because those at the very top simply don't understand how things work. They don't use the schools that other people use. So why would they be any good as a schools minister? They don't use the housing that other people use. They don't get a mortgage because they can buy housing in cash. So how would they know about housing? They're chauffeured around, so why would they worry about public transport? And so on and so on. This is the inequality curve for the United Kingdom. It's a fairly well-known curve. The important thing to know is that this is not the same curve as in all other rich nations. It is similar to the curve for the United States, except that the United States stayed very unequal until around about 1945. The first part of the curve is similar to most European countries. All European countries were incredibly unequal in the 1920s. They had an aristocracy that had servants. The top 1%, the best off 1%, took about 20% of all income. All European countries saw inequality fall. In the 1920s, 30s, 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s. There are many reasons why they saw inequality fall. There are many people who fought for it to fall. There were many fears. It's partly because Halford Mackinder failed. One little known fact about Halford Mackinder, the namesake of my chair, is that he accompanied the British forces into Russia to quell the revolution. If you're taught history in England, we don't tend to teach the bits where we didn't do too well, and we failed that. We also don't teach lots of other things. We don't teach about the Opium Wars, because we're a little bit embarrassed about the Opium Wars. Anyway, we all become more equal until the 1970s, when the best off 1% were only getting 6 times the average income after tax, which is the lower line, just 4 times average income. That means a top banker in London getting a salary today of £100,000 when the average person gets 4 times less, that £25,000. That really happened. I was there. I was growing up. I wasn't so nerdy as a child. I knew that was what was happening. But knowing that that was what Britain was like helps explain things about my childhood and the country I was living in and how it's changed. And then from 1979 onwards, we get that endless rise in inequality. The little symbols on the lines are general elections. It made no difference how you voted. It didn't actually matter. You didn't know at the time if you were voting. I didn't know. I thought it was terribly important how I voted. But it hardly alters. The divergence at the end is the 45p tax rate coming in. Well, it came in at 50 and then it was dropped down to 45. Tax rates can make a huge difference. Joe Stiglitz has a new book, I think, just out. Might be about to come out. And in Joe Stiglitz's book, he says that a 5% increase on marginal income tax in the United States only apply to the best of 1% in the United States, could fund all university education for free and childcare for free in the United States, because the best of 1% in the US are now taking 20% of all income. Now, what you're often told about this curve is it's inevitable. It's globalization, it's technology, it's talent, numerous reasons. That's a lie. It's a lie because this curve is very specific to the US and the UK and a few other very unequal countries. If you look at Switzerland, you see it carrying on going down. It's not that the Swiss lack talented people or that the Swiss are somehow immune from globalization. It's that the Swiss decided that they were not going to take part in this particular game. And the French, and the Germans, and the Japanese, and the Dutch, and the Norwegians, and I can go on and on. I'm going to go on and on, because I'm going to show you the list. Okay, this is a different measure of inequality. It comes from 2010. It's the income of the best off 10th to the worst off 10th in each country. It's UN data, which we could get from around about 2010. The most equal country, and this is now just the 25 richest countries in the world of at least 2 million people. So we're only looking at the rich world. Which is the more equal world? It is the world with the greater rates of equality. It's the world with welfare states. So the most equal country is Japan. Japan was incredibly unequal in the 1930s. Japan had equality imposed upon it by the Americans in an amazing natural experiment to see what happens if you make a country really equal. We have a lot to thank the Americans for, and it turns out the Japanese actually have quite a lot to thank. Longest life expectancy in the world now, a 90% middle class. All created by the Americans taking the land off the aristocracy at the end of the Second World War and distributing it as equally as they could. Not because the Americans believed in equality greatly at that point, because the Americans were very, very scared of revolution. And Japan was a very likely candidate to have a revolution after the war. After Japan, and neatly lined up, come Finland, Norway, and Sweden, where the best off 10th still have, this is disposable income after tax, of 6 times more than the poorest 10th. So none of this is about, you know, some socialist utopia. These are actual real places when real things are happening. And they still have large gaps. Then Germany, Austria, Slovenia, South Korea, Denmark, Belgium, and Switzerland. By this measure, Switzerland is nearer the middle. France, Netherlands, Ireland, Canada, Greece, Spain, Italy, New Zealand, Australia, and Israel. Right, now, Israel's a very unequal country. This is Israel including everybody who lives in the territory of Israel and the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. So you may not be surprised to see that level of inequality there in terms of the incomes, disposable incomes that people have. But then we get the United Kingdom, and we're more unequal than Israel across the whole of the United Kingdom. London, of course, is much more unequal than the rest of the United Kingdom. You are in the most unequal city in Europe at the moment. You have to go all the way over to San Francisco to find the equivalents. San Francisco produces lovely stories about how there's no district in San Francisco anymore where school teachers can afford to live. So you have to ask yourself how they manage to keep the schools going in San Francisco. In London, school teachers do manage to live, because they're canny enough to get a partner who works in finance very often. In Oxford, school teachers don't manage to live because we don't have enough people working in finance. And so when I go to the schools in Oxford, I find very few teachers aged over 25. And that, I think, is a bit of a problem. Anyway, let's talk about the most unequal countries, because they are interesting. And in a way, we're a natural experiment. There we are. Portugal was slightly more unequal than us, but the rich in Portugal have lost a hell of a lot in the last 5 years because of the halving of property values. The United States, by this measure, isn't much more unequal than us, and in fact is now on a trajectory by 2030 to become slightly less unequal than us. Barack Obama's actually increased taxes at the top. If somehow the Democrats manage to win the next election and carry on their policies in the US, we and the United States will cross over. And at the top is Singapore, which is a fascinating small country to study in terms of what is extreme inequality like, or if you like, what would a more unequal London look like in future? But even in Singapore, there are measures underway, very small, but particularly involving measures on investment, that might mean, and if you take the last two inequality statistics we have, do mean, if you do a straight line projection, you find that we will overtake Singapore by 2030. So the United Kingdom is destined to win the global race and become the most unequal rich country of the world, the way things are currently going. What happened in Singapore is after the crash of 2008, the government imposed restrictions on who could buy property, more restrictions than they normally had, because they were scared that Chinese investors might buy flats in Singapore and leave them empty. And you know now what those Chinese investors chose to do. They jumped over Singapore. If you're very nerdy, you can look at the small print and the small prints there. And as I said earlier, these are the kind of things that worry me. These figures do change. Portugal, Italy, Greece, Spain have actually all dropped out of the richest 25 countries of the world since 2008. I suspect they'll come back in again, but they have had an almighty shock because of the crash. Small oil states have probably temporarily jumped in, depends on the future price of oil. And the ratios have altered a little bit. If anybody finds this stuff fascinating, I always want to work with people who will look at these things. But just tell you, the inequality statistics, the best we can get, are not particularly stable. And the consumption statistics I'm going to show you in a minute are not particularly stable. Why do we get high rates of inequality, and why do places put up with them? It isn't that there is anything inherent in any group of people. Right. Japan was one of the most unequal countries in the world in the 1930s economically. It had the lowest life expectancy of the rich world. So there's nothing healthy about the Japanese diet in the 1930s, and it hasn't changed that much. It's events. One reason why the United Kingdom is as unequal as it is because it didn't lose the Second World War. But there are other reasons. In the 1970s, people argued for inequality. They argued that tall poppies should be allowed to rise, that the market should be unfettered, that you'd get trickle down. And they argued effectively, more effectively in the UK, with Thatcher in 1979 being elected, and in the US with Reagan being elected in 1980, than they argued in other countries. If you were interested in politics, if you are interested in politics, the 1970s were a good time to actually talk about politics and be engaged in it. You could really have an effect depending on where you were in the world. Now possibly might be a time when things are going to move around. Other people didn't argue well enough against the idea that you should allow inequality to rise in some countries rather than others. There are other reasons. Racism helps sustain inequality in the United States. If there wasn't racism, it would be almost impossible to justify the kind of inequalities that exist in the United States. Class differences, class structure, class understanding, a reversion back to looking down at people as below us and up to people as above us in the UK may partly make it easier. We find this uncomfortable and difficult to think about in the UK. Think, oh no, we're not so class bound. I suspect at least a third of you, maybe half of you, are not from the UK, and you can probably see just how class-bound we are. So I'll let you afterwards tell your neighbour if they don't believe about it, or the things we do that kind of give away this. But look at Singapore with the difference between the Malay and Chinese population, or look at Israel for the differences there. It's always easier when you're looking at another country than the one you're in. In most of the world, high rates of inequality are due to high rates of poverty. Most of the world is much more unequal than the United States. Even China has bigger inequality rates than the United States, and it's one of the more equal parts of the rest of the world. Apart from Kerala, Cuba and Costa Rica, there aren't many places you can actually go out of these richest 25 countries to find relatively high rates of equality. But lastly, I do think we tolerate high rates of inequality because we think, okay, it hasn't worked, trickle-down hasn't worked that well. But maybe trickle-down could work in one country. Maybe we could become the country that attracts more billionaires than any other country, and we must get something from those billionaires. You know, they need chauffeurs, they need servants. their children want to go to university. We can do all of that. And we think, oh, it's not great, but it's the future, and the repercussions aren't that bad. So it's the repercussions I want to talk to you about. And these are going to give you a very odd set of things, because I'm going to show you everything that we measured. This is work done this summer with Natasha Stokesbury. We published it in the Statistics Journal. We got it refereed. And it's just showing you the raw data. All the graphs are going to be of a similar form. Along the bottom, we've got that ratio, the best off tenth to the worst off tenth. So in Japan, it's one of the most equal countries. The USA is one of the most unequal. The size of the circle is proportional to population, so you don't get too obsessed by small countries, although they're all kind of natural experiments. And then along the y-axis here, we've got some measure of something people do. In this case, the quantity of meat on average they consume in kilograms per year. This is about the size, it's a small steak per day. It's the amount of meat that the British on average eat in one way or another. We can only eat this much now because we have factory farming. You go back 1.5 generations, not even two, and you would just eat meat on a weekend. You'd eat it once mainly. But enough battery farmed hens and you can eat meat a lot more often. The remarkable thing is that they eat 50% more meat in the United States than the United Kingdom. George Monbiot wrote about this week. I think, and I haven't checked these numbers, but something like, of all the large land animals in the world, forget the insects, all the large ones, 33% by weight is us, and about over 60% of the rest are things we farm so that we can eat them. And then the animals which are not things we farm, just hardly any of them by weight at all. 50% more meat eaten in the United States, United Kingdom. This meat is not eaten by the rich, because the rich would die if they ate that more meat. If you have seen Super Size Me, you'll know about that. The relationship kind of goes downwards. So why is it like this? I suspect it's like this because if you look at things like advertising, you'll find 4% of the GDP of this country is spent on advertising, 2% of ours, and 1% of the GDP in these countries. And we advertise things like McDonald's. We tell people they want to go out, they feel happier. If people would want to do it anyway, you wouldn't need to advertise it. Advertising is all about getting people to buy things they don't want to buy. But not just advertising, it's a lack of control. In the United States, people will argue, so what? So what if people are going to eat lots of meat and lots of sugar? It's their individual responsibility. You really shouldn't impinge on that in any way. Whereas in other countries, people might be happier to try to reduce it. And of course, there's always exceptions, okay? There are lots of sheep in New Zealand. Yeah, you might as well. But 5 years ago, the little circle up there was Denmark, and it was pigs. Anyway, just a vague relationship. I'm not saying one causes the other, but I say we need to look at it. We need to look at it, of course, because this is a massive emitter of greenhouse gas, methane in particular. We can easily feed the world if we just eat less meat or no meat. It really is easy. It is easy because you can only consume so many calories. It would be terrible if you could consume 5 times more calories than somebody else. Then we'd be in trouble. But because you can't, or even if you do, the repercussions are bad. Feeding the world is not a terrible problem. Of course, the obesity graph looks very similar to this. It's even tighter for a reason I'll show you in a minute. Water. Here's the water consumption. Again, same kind of pattern. Now I know, okay, you've got swimming pools here and here. But there are places down here where you could have swimming pools. And maybe we're down here because we don't have swimming pools, for good reason. Although we do have a bit too many swimming pools, really. When you fly out of London and you look down, you look at all the swimming pools, you've got to think, why do people have swimming pools in their gardens in England? You know, what is it? And in a more sensible country in a similar climate, would they be less disposed to have them? On a slightly serious note, if you've got children, if any of you have got children, you always worry about children. you can stop worrying about the vast majority of your worries about children. Paedophiles, there aren't enough of them, and so on. You can let your children climb up trees. We've done the paper on this. They will break their arms when they fall out of trees. They hardly ever die. You can let them go on play equipment in playgrounds. Only three things hurt children severely. Cars, worry about cars. When they're very small, worry about small objects in their throat, and worry about water. So why would you put a swimming pool in your garden? Or even worse, I was taken about 2 years ago to see a house in Mayfair, just a three-bed semi, that was worth 25 million. When it's worth 25 million, what happens is they dig two basements down, and in the very bottom basement, they put a swimming pool. Now again, you know, if you're going to have children, which is of course what you have if you've got a three-bed semi, the last thing you want in your house is a swimming pool. Anyway, vague relationship with water. This is much more interesting. Waste is much, much more interesting. And waste is interesting because absolutely everything you buy, apart from food, which goes out another way, although yeah, for fact you throw about half of it away, a third of it away, depends. Maybe in London you might throw more. Apart from food and jewellery, which you tend to hang on to, absolutely everything you buy within a short amount of time, often weeks or a few months, but if not that, years, will go in the bin. Right. So if you're trying to measure consumption, you can measure it by looking at the weight of waste. It tells you how much people are buying. You do, if you're trying to be clever, have to factor in recycling in this, so it's not so easy. But this is municipal waste, and again, just look at the difference. It's more than twofold for the United States to Japan. And here's my worry about statistics. I honestly think, having been to Switzerland and Denmark, that they are not that profligate. I think they've got really good at measuring waste. So they measure waste when you go and use another bin or throw it away in another way and so on. And it's a bugbear of my life that when people get good at measuring things, it appears to be worse. But in fact, it is that they're doing more careful measurements. CO2 emissions. Now, it isn't just that Australia and Canada are big countries. In the context of the United Kingdom, Scotland is a big country. But Scotland is a country which managed to arrange itself with the bulk of its population in two cities connected by public transport. You don't have to emit a lot of carbon dioxide just if you have a large amount of land area. You can arrange yourself in different ways. Gasoline on its own. Often these relationships, of course, without the United States wouldn't stack up, or the United States and Canada. You know, you're looking at a bundle down there, not a straight line. But all this does matter in terms of what's going to be talked about at Paris in a couple of weeks' time. And the question is, are you getting more reliance on the motor car here and here than you get in other places related to other things? So does our government think maybe we're going to have a few more motorways in future because we have a more individualistic government, whereas a government in a country with lower rates of inequality, when it's looking at how it's going to plan transport in the future, the last thing it thinks of doing is actually expanding cars. And health, just back to health again. The strongest relationship with ill health and income inequality is mental health, is poor mental health. With about a quarter of people in the United States are suffering from mental illness. It is much, much lower in Japan. But this is just showing you the raw infant mortality figures. Now these are very low. These are historically incredibly low. This is very, very good news. But you're still looking at twice as many grieving parents per capita in the United States as opposed to all these countries down here. The odd ones are always interesting. Singapore doesn't boast about having one of the lowest rates of infant mortality in the world. It has a very good health system. It has a very good couple of hospitals. But it also pregnancy tests all 100,000 maids every 3 months, and they're deported if they're pregnant. Now, if you deport the poor before they have their children, that gets your infant mortality rate very low. And of course, what happens is the maids actually have abortions rather than being deported. Much weaker relationship, a measure of ecological footprint. Sadly, the ecological footprint measures have become commercialised recently, so it's very hard to get ones that are for general use. Again, you can see the rough relationship, but again, some countries look out of step, and again, I worry that it may be better measures of people's consumption that is happening there. But the overall pattern is clear. People consume more, they waste more, they travel more in countries with greater economic inequality than in countries where they are more similar. And part of the reason is thought to be that people try to behave like the people who've got a little bit more than them. So in the UK, we go on more overseas holidays than people in similar countries. Because the people who've got a bit more than us, the people who've got a little bit more than me, they go to Tuscany for 2 weeks. I know they do. I'm envious. Tuscany is very nice. People fly out of this city and go skiing because that's the kind of thing you do in February, which might mean that you think I really ought to go skiing because they're going skiing. So you might borrow a bit more money so you can go skiing. So we have the highest debt per capita in Western Europe. Consumption increases when you have widening gaps between people, but partly because people's norms are affected by those who have a bit more than them. And if you've got a wide pulling out of the income and disposable income and wealth inequalities in the country, then the people who've got a bit more than you have quite a lot more than you. And you don't tend to look down, because looking down is very frightening. And flights. Now again, of course, exceptions. If you're in New Zealand, there really isn't any other way to get off New Zealand. Norway, in a way, is like an island. It's similar, Canada. But again, I should have marked out Germany. I think it's around about there, that one. Business people in Germany tend not to fly. They use the trains. It's the culture of using the trains. Whereas somehow we've managed to engineer things so it's cheaper to fly with Ryanair halfway across Europe than it is to take a train from here to Manchester. And that was a remarkable feat of economics to do that. But we've managed to do it, and it will increase the overall pollution we get. It also won't make us much happier. It's just 3% of people consume 50% of flights. These are business travellers. It's just 3% of customers. They suffer from jet lag, deep vein thrombosis. The diet's awful. Their relationships with their family tend to go pretty badly. We have an idea that this kind of lifestyle is, you know, great, the idea of jetting around the world. But it may not be. It may not, you know, even flying around the world in first class, after the first few times you've done it, I'm not yet in that category, but I do suspect, I'm willing, if anybody wants to sponsor me, by the way, to test this, I do suspect that it actually becomes a bit of a drag doing that. The effects of inequality on us. We begin to trust each other less. So politics becomes very polarised in unequal countries, less polarised in more equal countries. More equal countries are much better at introducing PR and letting everybody have a political party they might want to vote for. The more unequal ones, we used to have just three parties, we're getting a few more now. The US just has two, Singapore really only has one. You get less democracy, but also less trust. We understand each other less because we mix less. So it's harder to get things right because you don't live the lives of other people. And this applies to everybody. There is no person in an unequal country who is so socially diverse that they actually know what it feels like to be there and feels like to be there and so on. You can't do it. Every so often an MP or a celebrity will try to live on the dole for a week and they embarrass themselves. You know, they might manage to actually physically do it, but of course mentally they realise that they can only do it for a week. Many of you look like you're students or have recently been students. Exam results become more and more important in unequal countries. We become more competitive because, of course, you know, you could have four times more than somebody else in an unequal country. Whereas in a more equal country, you can be more steered to do what you want to do, not what you think you have to do to get enough money to get by. I'm going to show you just two more graphs on this in a minute, because this is data we only got this summer. I suspect this affects learning, and I'll show you why. I'm going to take mathematics as an example, but we've got the same data now for literacy and the same for problem solving. Problem solving is I show you the net of a cube and ask you what it makes when you fold it round. So these are not particularly complicated questions. The maths is a bit harder. Now, here's the relationship. The more unequal countries, if we do a standard maths test, and you can do a standard maths test to children, this is age 15 and 16, I think. The more unequal countries do worse at maths. The more equal countries do better. Singapore annoyingly does incredibly well, although we have to check who's actually taking the tests in Singapore. So you've got a relationship, but it's a fairly weak relationship, so what am I going on about? Why do I get excited about this? Now remember, this is 15-year-olds at maths. Now, you've all been tested at maths. I'm guessing most of you did. Let's try. How many of you were educated in the United Kingdom? Okay. Keep your hand up if you got an A or an A star. So the vast majority of hands stay up. Okay, well done, you got an A and an A star. So the question is, how good are you at maths? Just have a think about it. We're going to do the same test, exactly the same test. This was done in 2012. The data comes from the OECD. It's a very simple comparison. It's not their complicated comparisons, which I complain about sometimes. Same test up to age 24. And now look at the results. Now, and if there's something in this, and we get the same for literacy, and we get the same for problem solving, it really matters to us. The United States is way at the bottom. United Kingdom is only just above it, and almost second to the bottom. And this cluster of countries are so much better at maths. Now, the only explanation I have for this is that in these two countries, we are teaching people at school at age 15 or 16 how to get an A star rather than an A, or how to get an A rather than a B, or how to get a C rather than a D, because a C means you can get a job like working in the police force. A D means it's McDonald's for you. That is a divide. An A means you can go to Russell Group University, a B means you can't. An A star means you can be slightly fancy about your Russell Group University. Right, these grades really, really matter. So what we're doing, what's happened to you, particularly if you're younger, is you were taught how to get the maximum result at age 15, 16 in your GCSE. Some of you may have gone on to A levels, which is a lot better, but still we pushed you to get the maximum result at your A level. We didn't teach you maths. We didn't teach you to enjoy maths. We didn't teach you to actually solve problems without telling you the steps to go through so you could do it. We taught you to the test. And we didn't teach you to the test in the United Kingdom, the United States, because we're nasty. We taught you to the test because it really matters, because our schools are being graded by the results you get. And if your school is seen as coasting, Ofsted are sent in to take it over. But we also taught you to the test because it affects your life chances so much. It really matters. People won't give you a second chance at 18 or 21 if your score isn't so good. And while we were doing all of that, we weren't teaching you to enjoy maths or literacy or problem solving. We weren't teaching you how to approach a problem that you might not be familiar with or that you forgot from 8 years ago and think, oh, how do I do this? If you're my age, you get to do this again because you have children who are doing maths GCSE and you sit down and try and do their homework with them. And it's barely possible to do it. So my worry is that what we've done in these two countries in particular is de-skill ourselves through our supposed amazing education competitive system. Obviously needs to be a lot more work on this, but if this is happening, it's a real indictment of highly unequal countries that supposedly get top talent to the top. Now you might think that, oh, in the States it's because there are lots of people here and there's a great big mass down here and they don't matter. You've still got the few really, really bright people in the States. And you will find, if you ask people in the United Kingdom and the United States, you will find that very large numbers of them will tell you that they are in the top quarter of ability. well over half the population will tell you they're in the top quarter of ability. If you ask people here, they don't tell you that. It's not just that they're more numerate, they're also more modest in more equal countries. Last graph for you. Now, what I'm not showing you is alcohol and cigarettes, where there is no relationship. And that's interesting. People smoke an enormous amount in Japan. They drink an awful lot in France. Now, there's lots of things you don't get relationships with. But you can individually choose to do these things. It's slightly hard work in Japan because they have these you've got to have a car to be allowed to buy cigarettes now in Japan. But there are ways around it, but it's not easy. And you've also supposedly got to have somebody else to pour the drink into your glass in Japan, which is a good way of stopping people drink too much on their own. But in general, some behaviours are not connected to inequality. But this, which is the proportion of people who walk and cycle to work, is related to inequality. In the Netherlands, it's over 50% of the population. Hasn't always been 50% of the population. The story I've been told about the Netherlands is that in the 1970s, a group of parents became so angry that their children were at such a risk of harm and death from cars. Because remember, this is the most likely way in which children die in these countries, that they lobbied to change the planning system to try to minimise the number of deaths. In Sweden, they have an official target of not a single person should die on the roads. Human lives are worth about 4 million, four times more in these countries for cost-benefit analyses than they're worth in Britain. We put a human life at 1 million. And then we can work out how many people have to die before you put a subway, and so on. There is good news. There's good news. 100 local authorities now have got 20 mile an hour limits. So things are getting better in this country, but they've been getting better more in other places. It isn't just that, though. That's just the Netherlands story. In general, the more economically equal your country, the more likely you are to zone things so that people can live nearby where they work, the more likely you are to put in train and tram systems, the more likely you are to paint cycleways. You cannot individually go out on a London street and paint yourself a cycle lane. Like, you have to do it collectively. So I'm not saying that this causes this. What I'm saying is they're related. People who are better organised get themselves into a situation where they don't have to sit in cars getting fatter and fatter. It's the best way, apart from eating, the other thing to get fat is to sit in the car, because you can only exercise your fingers and your foot on the gas pedal. And in the USA, it's 3.5% of the population. Why is it so low in the USA? A few years ago, a mayor in Texas was quoted as saying, when somebody wanted to introduce pavements, that pavements shouldn't be introduced because they were collective. Pavements were the road to communism. With cars. Now, what really worries me, is what do we say in the United Kingdom that people go and tell themselves stories in Norway about, you won't believe what I heard in England the other day. But to give us some credit, it has only been since the 1970s and 80s that this divergence in these countries has occurred. It's an incredible natural experiment. And the importance of the natural experiment of what the rich countries of the world have done by diverging in all kinds of ways, public spending. Finland over 50%, we're now down to around about 35%, lowest public spending apart from Ireland in Europe. We're producing data sets that allow people in the rest of the world to have a look and say, which way do you want to go? What works best? What works best in terms of the mental health of people, in terms of their education, in terms of the cost of housing? What works best in terms of how they get to work? What works best in terms of whether people are healthy? What works best in terms of how much water you're going to have to suck out of your aquifers to supply them with that? What works best in terms of how much energy you're going to have to produce for people? If you're going to try and produce it by wind or solar instead of fossil fuels, it's far easier if people are not so greedy for energy. So what makes people more greedy for energy? And it could well be keeping up with the Joneses. I'm almost there. I don't think we should kick ourselves too much about this. I think it's also quite telling that the United Kingdom was the richest country on earth 100 years ago. The United States is the richest country on earth now. Great inequality is very expensive. It could almost only be afforded by places that have had great wealth. The people who are most affected by this are the young. It is the young in this country who are getting enormous PFI debts to pay back on the hospitals. It's the young who are getting the student debts. So far, only 3 years' worth of young people have got the roughly £56,000 debts, but higher if you do slightly better in the labour market. But by 2020, it'll be 8 years' worth. But in the United States, the student debt bubble is even larger. In more equal countries, of course, or maybe not, of course, because you might not know. The norm in more equal countries is you don't give people student loans, you just give them a free university education. That's just normal to do. But also, in more unequal countries, the bulk of the young, even if they've gone to university, are never going to get salaries high enough to get them outside of renting, and the rents aren't controlled. So they've got to pay even higher rents. And the quality of the housing is worse. So you're paying more for something that's worse for the majority of you, even though you've gone to university. I don't think that this is sustainable in the unequal countries of the rich world. I really don't think you can educate the majority of the population, even if we teach people to the test that makes them dumber, and give them this particular deal for too long. I think it's only happened because it's been an experiment, and theoretically the experiment could have been thought to have been something that might have worked. It might have been efficient. It turns out it wasn't efficient. But the most important thing of all is if you all behave like people in the United States, if the whole world behaved like everybody in the United States, we're going to need four planets. If the whole world behaves as people behave in Japan, you need two. That's still one planet too many. But it's a lot more achievable to go from a Japanese lifestyle to something that's truly sustainable, rather than have the idea that one day we in the United Kingdom are almost there, and everybody else in the world should behave like Americans. And I think we've got to come clean and say, this went wrong, we know all about it because it's our lives, we've lived through it, and collect more and more data about the repercussions and see what's required to change it, in which places has equality actually risen. There has in some. How does that come about? What happens when consumption falls? Consumption has fallen in some cases. There is some good news. But before we get onto that, we need to say what we've got wrong. Because the people who shout the loudest, the people who write most of the papers in the journals of the world, the people who produce most of the academic books, have been living in the two parts of the world which have got the worst track record on social and economic inequality, and then on environmental damage. Thank you very much.
A rather dystopian vision perhaps of where we are at the moment, where we might be going. I think the intention now is to have about 10 minutes of questions, so if Danny takes a seat and makes himself comfortable. Have we got a couple of roving microphones? Yes, we have. And we'll try and take a few questions to follow up. So who'd like to kick off? Front here.
I'm Neha Mahuja, working as a climate policy researcher at the Energy and Resources Institute in India, and also visiting KIMS as Jim Bulbul Fellow. So basically I work on climate policy and the environmental space, and I was just concerned about the analysis, some analysis I've done with respect to developing country and inequality in development and inequality in climate policy shaping in. And I was curious to know if you have done analysis on developed country inequality as well as the natural resources and conflicts therein, because in the near future we'll be having natural resource conflicts arising out of it, climate change is a challenge, other environmental are also there. So do we really have some information or databases which we can use to do some sort of analysis?
Okay. Yeah. Can we think on India, on the consumption of different income groups in India, and the condition, and then the enormous prices that are applying, and also in Canada. And the worries about resources are immense compared to this. The worries about water how much water the Chinese are going to divert from the Himalayas in one direction. Okay, the other way of India is the aquifers. I mean, nowhere else on the earth is it draining the aquifers quite as fast as in India. And you do have to worry if Coca-Cola is allowed into India uncontrolled and then drains water out of aquifers faster because it's seen as, you know, somehow the free market will settle this. You know, water will reach a price which is worthwhile. We've kind of learned that it doesn't work that way. Having been done used for this, a lot of this data was less than 10 years old. A lot of it was created than the any development goals. So that's why we have so much. Because when you set some goals, the poor statisticians in the UN have to come up with some numbers everywhere. And so suddenly you have an enormous increase in statistics about the world, which makes it possible to build on these things.
Okay, and yes, slide it here. Yeah.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for that. That was really interesting. As you can tell, I'm Australian, so there was some very interesting facts there. I'm also a maths educator here at King's, so also interesting assets about the runner. I was interested in what your thoughts might be about your prediction of the future of statistics, given the high rates of youth unemployment in countries around the Mediterranean and with migration that we're seeing now. If you've thought about how that might have an impact in the next few years.
Yeah. We've got 25 million unemployed under 25 in Europe. We've never had less people under 25. We've never had fewer babies. So there should have been a blessed generation. And we haven't got anything for them to do. At the same time, though, in the countries with very low employment rates, like the UK and the USA, people are being forced to do jobs that they wouldn't otherwise do. The extent of the forcing is quite unprecedented. So over a million people were sanctioned 2 years ago for not turning up job interviews. Not turning up interviews is anything, even if they have a job interview. The fines on the million people were sanctioned in the UK were more than the entire fines given out by all magistrates' courts and Scottish Sheriff's Office in 1 year. So that shows the degree which we are forcing people to take any job. Since 2008, just looks like chaos. The statistics look like chaos. It makes it very hard to make predictions of any kind of certainty. But it just seems impossible that you could have the smallest generation ever of young people, the most highly educated generation of ever young people, have a growing elderly population which is going to have various needs and sustain it. The innovation coming into Europe doesn't even help match it. It helps a little bit. It's not going to reduce it. But I think my honest answer is we've had chaos since 2008. And we need a way out of the chaos. It is similar to 1929. Shortly after 1929, unemployment in the United States, I think, reached 30 million. At which point they sacked the statisticians because the government couldn't afford to keep them anymore. And then they brought in a New Deal in the United States. And I suspect we're out of the European New Deal, where you find work for people, you give them a choice, and you don't pay that slave labour. You have to give people choices of things to do. There's nothing that needs to be doing. There are things that need to be fixing, or homes that need to be built. I suspect we need European New Deal to get back to this work.
Okay, thank you. Yes?
Hi. I'm an undergrad at Oxford, and I was just thinking that if you take the USA out of most of those graphs you showed and call it an outlier, because obviously it's such a large population compared to the rest of them, as artificial as that may be, lots of the graphs don't seem to have any particular correlation. So I was thinking, wouldn't a better way of demonstrating differences between countries be do it, showing it over time rather than as a snapshot in time, and seeing how increased inequality affects the movement of countries around this world?
What subject are you doing, Oxford?
Human sciences.
Right. I mean, I'm actually one of the lucky ones. Come and see me and help me. you're right. But I think it's mainly, because if you get better data, they tend to work a little bit better. I'm not showing you the things that were plotted in the spirit level. And in the spirit level, well, they can take the United States out of each one, and it's still significant how some of their ash and what they include. The other thing you can do is you can not show the United States, but show every state in the circle. And then it'll affect you. It seems to have a in this Mississippi, which is very different when they're thinking of Wisconsin. That's a bit cheating to do that. That's what we like to do in China. Because you divide them up and then bring in look, because Kerala is incredibly equal and have very good life expectancy. My feeling is that the statistics are so poor that that's causing it. And the reason I feel that is that around 85 years later, I find these huge jumps that really can't happen. So people have measured things in a different way. So we're going to need some really fairly boring work done. Just checking things like how much meat and fish, you know, are people, it can't be impossible to work it out. But you need to work out how much meat and fish is being thrown away and how much is actually going into people's bodies. And do you care as much as the stuff that's being thrown away as the stuff that people are eating? And what really matters?
Okay, got time for just one more. Anyone else? Yes? Sorry, at the top. Yeah, if you can shout out, because...
Yeah, your analysis seemed very demarcated around nation-state boundaries. And I was wondering if the implication of that was that any possible solutions were on a national basis as opposed to an international basis.
Okay, very good question, Basil. People have looked at smaller areas like cities, and this relationship is much weaker, smaller areas, and they've looked at larger areas as weaker. A nation state tends to have a similar culture, same national TV, maybe a change with more TV channels, but the same message is beamed into every household. We don't have people watch TV 30 hours a week. Yeah. And also the same language, which might help protect some countries. But I don't think if you had a class of 25 children, you wouldn't class the children who are doing worse in their class to sort themselves out. You know, in a way, telling us and the Americans we need to sort ourselves out. You know, we're used to this now, we think there are attitudes. I think it does need sorting out at the wider level. And people were far too polite in these other countries, especially pointing out a bit more strongly, look, this is what you're doing in the UK, this is what you're doing in the UK. And you're telling us that we should do something different? You know, we go around the world telling people how to organise themselves, how to organise their economies. But the median family in this country is on about 4,000 fewer euros a year than the median family in France. And we have the goal to tell the French that we think that they don't know how to run an economy. So, I would agree with you, it needs to be sorted out on the right level. Part of that sorting out is people in these more polite places, and I'm afraid polite is not based as well. People in these more polite countries actually say to the United Kingdom and the United States, you are right to shout so loudly it's the finish line facts. And that needs to be done. I would love to stay in the European Union. I think we probably will stay in the European Union. But if we were to leave the European Union, I think it would be quite amazing.
We've got one more question from the very front, and then we'll wrap up.
Hello, good evening, sir. We are delighted to have you here in our distinguished lecture series. I'm Mary Bolanes, an LLM student here at King's National Scholar. How may we know your thoughts about the seeming inequality between the developed and developing countries, particularly in the implementation of the better national term contributions in the climate change?
The worldwide inequality statistics are fascinating. In some cases, in the middle, they kind of come together. China statistics bring them out on this. What's staggering is what's happening in the extremes. The very poorest are not getting much air off. More bad people stay in the yard, the people stay not really getting very much, and hunger isn't going down very much. The most scary thing to the top, the richest 4% in the world, now have over half the world's wealth. They put their head on something to try and make you feel happy. Last year, Capgemini, and it was a Canadian bank. It keeps on changing because it
trying to say bus. So that the banks is also the World Bank Report change, because of the banks here, but the World Bank Report, which came out saying that the British sports center now has over half a million miles now, also said that it was going up by 7% in 1 year. If that was to happen for another 7 years, that's 49%, they would have everything. And that came over. What that tells you is that you are living through a very, very strange time right now. And it cannot carry on like this. And you get a city like that. There are going to be many, many events, more events, it's like climate change. There's going to be more turbulent weather in the years to come than there was in the 1980s or the 1990s. You can see that in the city. What it's going to be, it's not going to be peaceful, it's not going to be quiet, it's not going to be easy. It is going to be rather like 1939 and 1933 and 1918, which was the last time that we actually in this country became more equal. We don't become more equal, just to say, it would be nice. But you actually have to do a bit more work. Thank you very much.
Before that descent into chaos.